and welcome to the second edition of the Martlet Sports Roundtable. I'm the sports lifestyle and humor editor, Taylor McKee, and I'm joined by Cormac O'Brien,
hello,
writer of hundreds upon thousands of articles for the Martlet with various topics. Also joined by Alistair Ogden,
hello,
our resident expert about MLS and other things soccer. We're here to talk soccer today. We're talking Canadian soccer specifically. And I think the first place we should start is some relatively breaking news. So I don't know when you're listening to this, but over the weekend, Victoria lost a venerable soccer institution. Cormac, explain what happened to the Highlanders. What went wrong? What is this? And first of all, I guess, what is this team and what is their sort of role?
So the Victoria Highlanders are a team that play in the Pacific Development League, which is basically a league where there's some semi-professional teams like the Highlanders themselves, and then there's a lot of U23 teams and youth teams for a couple MLS teams. So in the PDL, off the top of my head, I know the Whitecaps have a U23 team, and so do the Portland Timbers. So there's a couple youth teams for MLS teams, but I think the majority of the teams are semi-professional like the Highlanders were. But like you said, yeah, they closed over the weekend due to financial reasons, and the owner, Alex Campbell, basically came out and said they haven't run a profit since 2009. Oh. The club was developed, was kind of put forward in 2008, so it's not been particularly happy life for them. And yeah, they've closed down pretty suddenly, though. Not too many people had kind of any clue that it was going to happen.
Yeah, this was in the middle of the night. This sort of just came out, and this is a pretty big blow for Victoria soccer.
Totally, yeah. The Highlanders was definitely the highest level soccer team in Victoria, so the closure, you know, doesn't spell good things for any Victoria-based players who are looking to really get exposed to higher professional leagues.
Exactly, and I think that's sort of the most important sort of...
Totally, yeah. Off the top of my head, a player called Brett Levis, who played for the Highlanders last summer, so the summer of 2013, he signed from the Highlanders directly to the Whitecaps, PDL team, and he'll now play for the NASL team.
USL Pro, thank you.
The Highlanders was a great place for players to really kind of show off what they can do to hire and better teams. So it's a real big blow that they're gone now.
So it was but for younger players, right? Like under.
There were a few older players. They had one guy, Blair Sturrock, who was a Scottish player who'd played in all sorts of divisions in England. So there were a couple of older veteran players.
Oh, fantastic. So, that's not fantastic. That sucks. Yeah. So, specifically bringing this back to you, Vic, is there a relationship between the Vikes soccer program and the Highlanders?
So, a lot of the Vikes players who would be living in Victoria, homegrown players for them, they'll have particular trouble now. I spoke to Tarnvir Bandal, who plays for the Vikes as a midfielder. He's only in second or third year, I believe, so he's still quite young, like you said. And he's now got a problem because he might not particularly want to leave Victoria to play at a higher level, but he will have to now because the Highlanders team is gone. And it's going to have repercussions for the UVic team as they're going to, they might not have the chance to get as much fitness and game time during the summer as they would have before.
Right, and so you're saying that the Whitecaps have a development team in the Pacific League?
That's right.
Well, they had a Premier Development team before, which played against Victoria, and they actually had what was called the Wanda Fuca plate, which they played for every year. It was a fun sort of thing. But now because of the Whitecaps USL Pro team, they folded their PDL team. So
they've completely now, it's gone?
The PDL team is gone, and the Victoria PDL team is gone, so there's no more PDL in British Columbia.
And I imagine that would be the same for the Timbers as well, for all MLS teams.
For the MLS teams that are getting USL Pro teams, which is a lot of them now.
Because that's a huge problem then, as a development sort of model for MLS.
Yeah, well, for the Whitecaps, it works out because they have their academy, and then USL Pro, and then the first team. Whereas before, when their PDL team, the PDL is quite a bit lower level than the MLS team, so the players on their PDL team weren't really making the jump to the first team.
Okay, so I guess for people who are unfamiliar with this sort of system, there's the MLS.
Yeah.
Is there like a farm?
The USL Pro teams are kind of the equivalent of farm teams at the moment. They're kind of coming into fashion now. You've got a bunch of MLS teams with USL Pro affiliates. But the way it works, you've got MLS, then NASL, which is a second tier North American Soccer League, which isn't really affiliated with MLS or USL Pro. So
that's professional as well, though, yes?
Yeah.
So that's like FC Edmonton has a team in that league?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And the New York Cosmos actually signed Raul. Kind of went totally under the radar, but yeah.
Like the Raul?
The Raul, the one who scored all the goals for Real Madrid and is now hundreds of years old and is playing in New York. And so...
Are they a feeder system to the Red Bulls?
No. Are they far? No, they're separate. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there was... Now there's a whole bunch of teams in New York.
And then below that there's the PDL.
USL Pro and then USL PDL.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So there is a fairly involved ecosystem with MLS and feeder teams, but now that the link to Vancouver Island is now, I guess, severed.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there's not a whole lot here anymore.
The Vikes, I guess traditionally that would have been a pretty strong option for their players who have graduated. Mm-hmm. Also could have left school to join professional soccer as well in some ways.
Totally.
They're playing each other, the Vikes and the Whitecaps. Have a game coming up, right? Cormac's going to be attending and covering it.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the loss of the Highlanders, if we're being a little bit dramatic about it, this is one of the last chances that these Vikes players will really have to make an impression on Whitecaps coaches if they want to, you know, really make this next step up. And there are definitely a couple of players that I think will be looking to seize that opportunity.
Who do you think has a good shot at the Vikes right now?
Well, there's a player called Michael Bart who's finishing his first year at UVic now. He had a really, really good first season, signed directly from St. Michael's University School in Victoria. He scored 4 goals in 12 games, which is a decent amount of goals, but it's more impressive considering that this is his first year.
He's a freshman, yeah.
He was, a lot of the times he was playing kind of up front on his own as a target man role, so that is impressive. And then another name that I was kind of keeping an eye on was Dominic Colantonio, who's a third-year winger. He'll definitely have a big role with UVic next year as they're losing a couple big midfield players. He scored 4 goals as well this year, including a really important brace against UBC, which helped get them to the playoffs. So I imagine he'll be really looking to have a good game as well.
And what kind of squad should we expect from the Whitecaps here?
Well, that's really interesting because last year I had a look at the lineup and, I mean, they had sort of a few first-team players that were making the lineup, but in the first preseason game the Whitecaps just played today against New England, they had pretty much, they had Pedro Morales, Octavio Rivero, and Matias Laba all playing at various times in the game, and that's 3 of their designated players, so the big money players. So there is a chance we could see some of them in Victoria, if not all of them.
So just so for the benefit of everyone else, so the MLS has a system where you're allowed 2 designated players or 3?
3 designated players.
So and what does a designated player mean?
So basically, there's a sort of convoluted salary cap system that goes on in MLS that nobody exactly knows what's going on there. But from what I understand, the 3 designated players only count for a certain amount against the salary cap.
Oh, okay.
And the rest of the money that they're getting paid just comes directly from the owners of the team.
Oh, wow. So, and Alistair, you wrote a story a week ago about TFC sort of venturing into the designated player market again.
Yeah.
We all sort of, if we follow the MLS at all, we were familiar with the bloody big deal and Jermaine Defoe, and that was sort of left in tatters. So explain what happened this offseason.
So, there was the bloody big deal where they signed Jermaine Defoe and Michael Bradley, and before that, Gilberto. And obviously that didn't work out incredibly well for them. Defoe kind of got off to a really good start, and then after he didn't make the World Cup, he just kind of got upset and got injured and didn't play very well. So he's been traded to Sunderland, back to the Premier League, and coming the other way is Jozy Altidore, the U.S. men's national team striker, who, to put it bluntly, did pretty terribly with Sunderland. He scored a couple of goals, if that, in 40 appearances.
Okay.
Didn't impress the coaches, obviously, so they've shipped him back, and he's going to be paid loads of money by Toronto FC.
Do we know the figures yet? That was sort of sketchy at first.
Not exactly, yeah. He's not going to be one of the highest paid players in the league, but millions, of course.
Yeah.
The big money player will be Sebastian Giovinco, who's come over from Juventus, and he isn't exactly a big name. Not many people outside of Italy would have really heard of him, but he has played for the Italian national team. won't anymore because they have a sort of unofficial policy of only playing players that play in Italy on the national team.
So you have to play in Serie A to be considered for that unofficially?
Unofficially, yeah. Yeah, especially if you're going to Toronto FC, you really don't have much of a chance.
That was what Defoe, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think he didn't really realize. Apparently there was a rumor that Drake had convinced him to come and play for Toronto or something like that. Obviously, Drake did a good job of not giving him all the facts about Toronto. But that's another issue. But yeah, Giovinco, he's going to be... The figures are so high that people have generally come to a consensus he's going to be paid $7 million after taxes.
Wow.
Plus bonuses, whatever ends up happening, which could make him the highest paid player in the league.
And that's $7 million a year as well, right?
Yeah,
that's
a year,
amazing.
Yeah.
So explain what kind of player... So you're saying he's not a big name. Mm-hmm. Altidore, I think, is a more recognizable name in North America.
Yeah.
Why would TFC go out there and bid against what I'm guessing are other Serie A teams, other Premier League teams,
yeah,
for a guy who I believe is a woodland nymph, right? He's tiny, right? He's how tall is he? 5'5"?
5'5", something like that.
That's amazing. So
he is not a very big player.
I guess that doesn't really have any bearing on his abilities, but what kind of player are we expecting for that?
Well, he's sort of a center forward, attacking mid type of player. People are sort of debating what exact position he's going to be playing in Toronto, but what they really needed last year was a creative midfielder, and that's what he is. He's not big, obviously, he's not going to win a lot of balls in the air, but he will create things and make things happen, and he is very skillful.
Okay.
So hopefully what Toronto FC will be hoping is that they'll have sort of solid back line, then Michael Bradley, sort of the box-to-box midfielder, Giovinco just in front of him, and then Altidore up top to get on the end of the crosses and plays that could happen, which they do look better than they did last year, I have to say, because they signed Gilberto and Defoe, which both solid strikers, and then Michael Bradley. And then other than that, they really didn't have someone who could create a lot.
Okay. So no one could give him the ball, no one could service
these
guys. Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know what you'd have to do to be worth $7 million a year.
Yeah, in MLS, like, is that, like, what would a, describe what, in the context of MLS salaries, like, what are we talking here? $7 million, that sounds like, that's a big salary in the NHL.
Yeah, so $7 million, the only player who has a higher base salary is Kaká.
Where's he playing?
He's playing with Orlando, and he's just
being... Oh, that's an expansion team, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He's being paid... just about $100,000 more, and I mean, Kaká.
Oh, just in the same sort of...
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, Kaká has played for Real Madrid, and he's a Brazilian legend, so
he's
almost...
Name.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
He's going to sell a lot of shirts.
I mean, you'd think after a relatively large risk that an MLS team especially, we can talk about this more broadly, MLS is in a weird sort of transitional phase right now between... The league is growing, for sure.
Yeah.
There's FC Orlando and a second team in New York, right?
Yeah, New York City FC. Yeah.
You wrote a piece a while ago about sort of the expectations for an expanding MLS.
Yeah.
How does this position MLS teams in terms of the risk, sort of risk, the cost-benefit analysis of getting a player worth that much money? Is it worth the risks involved, or can you bankrupt a franchise?
Well, I don't think it's going to bankrupt Toronto because they're part of the Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment Group.
Absolutely,
which is just rolling around in money. So
would they want to bankroll a black hole, though? For how long would they want to?
Well, it's partly getting paid for because they're selling a lot more season tickets and they're expanding their stadium a little bit. And I guess they're hoping to sort of grow the brand, you know, and stuff like that. But, I mean, they're not the Highlanders, so they can probably take it. But yeah, it is interesting. Obviously, they're not going to be making money off of these kind of transactions.
These are investments, I guess.
Yeah.
They're
well, they're definitely going to want I mean, they're spending that kind of money on one player, and, you know, they will be spending quite a bit more on Altidore as well. I can't imagine that they'll be going into the season not thinking we have to make the playoffs, or even, you know, we have to have a decent run of the cup.
Yeah, I remember that last year. Yeah. I remember they've got Defoe, they have to be relevant, at least in the discussion. And they were until they weren't. It was really weird. They just sort of fell off a cliff again. Seems to be a Toronto trope at this point.
It really is, yeah.
But from a Whitecaps perspective, that's a different conference. They take a different approach. I don't recall any big names in the history of that franchise.
I think the biggest name that came in recent times was Nigel Riococher, which isn't exactly a big name. I think he played for, West Ham before he came?
I mean, Riococher was supposed to be this big player. You know, he was captain of West Ham at age 19 or something like that.
Oh, my God.
But then he just sort of became an average player, came over here, had one good season, scored one fluke goal, and then he
with the Caps, did he do that?
Yeah.
What position is he? What does he play?
He's just a central midfielder.
Okay, so goal scoring, not really even.
No. Okay. He was more of a sort of leadership figure, you know.
Like a Michael Bradley type, or
he's similar, I'd say. Yeah.
Less creative, I think. More of a holding midfielder, protect the back four.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the Whitecaps have a different attitude towards building a franchise, right? Like TFC seems to be sort of the New York Knicks type. You buy the names, and then the people will come, and hopefully we assemble the best video game-esque team we can. They'll just win. Is that how do the Whitecaps build their team?
Well, I think they're really looking at a lot of younger guys. Alistair, I mean, you probably know more about this than I do, but players like Kakuta Mane and Russell Tybert, and even the new striker they've brought in, Diego Rivero.
Rivero. Well, there's Diego Rodriguez as well. But basically what Carl Robinson, the coach, has come out and said that they're not going to spend big money on players. The biggest money move they made, they sold Camilo Sanvezo against their will, but that's another story. But that was kind of the biggest money move they made, was selling him. And then they brought in Pedro Morales, and he's making the most money on the team, but nothing exorbitant.
So if you look at the teams that do well in MLS.
Yeah.
Are they spending big money? Like, are the Galaxy spending money?
Yeah. Well, the Galaxy spend money, but they're smart with their money, and they don't just buy big players and then sort of fill up the rest of their roster with whoever, which is kind of what Toronto FC did.
They do sign big names, though, right? They signed Beckham, and they're sort of, they're not immune to this sort of pull of, we need to sell tickets with names.
Yeah, and they got Gerrard just recently as well, so.
So, and Keane, I believe, played for
Robbie Keane. Yeah, he's still there.
If you're a Whitecaps season ticket holder, or if you're thinking about buying a season ticket to the Whitecaps, what keeps you from being like, well, how are we ever going to compete with?
Well, it's not so much, I mean, the big names bring people to the stadium, but you got to get results, and you got to play exciting football to get people to stay there. And the Whitecaps do play exciting football. Last year, Pedro Morales is known now for these just massive cross-field balls and these amazing through balls, and then you'll get, you know, Kakuta Mane and hopefully Octavio Rivero on the end of them this year. And the atmosphere and the gameplay is what Vancouver Whitecaps are sold on, rather than the big money players.
Well, that brings up a very good point that I think you both can speak to. MLS's sort of role in the emerging sort of sports landscape in North America, specifically in Vancouver. You were saying there that you think it's the sort of style of play, and it's the sort of the excitement and the quality of the whole team that brings people to the stadium. Do you think MLS has reached the point now where, or especially in the Vancouver market, where soccer's a big enough sort of, the soccer itself, they'll come for the soccer, not just the celebrities. Do you think that Vancouver's reached that point?
I think they're getting there. You know, only half of BC Stadium is full for the games. I think they might be able to fill more of it with a playoff game, or maybe even a Cascadia Cup rivalry against Seattle or Portland or something like that. Mm. Another thing about BC Place is there's the turf there, which is going to get replaced for the Women's World Cup. But a lot of big name players don't want to play on turf. Even Thierry Henry never came to play in Vancouver because of the turf. So it's hard to get big money players just because of that reason.
Oh, and that's a wasp's nest, the turf discussion. I mean, that's a big discussion, not just in soccer, it's in baseball as well. turf has become a very, very, very hot button issue, especially with the Women's World Cup coming up this year.
That's the big one, yeah.
So let's get into the turf discussion, I guess. This is a big one. I mean, you have I ran an interview with Benjamin Massey earlier, a couple months ago, talking about the discrimination suit filed in the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, I think.
Yeah, something.
And suffice to say, it's a big, big deal. Not just for, you know, the Stars. I don't think Beckham played in Montreal when they went to. Oh, he did actually when they went to the Big O.
Yeah, Beckham wasn't too fussy. I mean, he came and played in BC Place back in 2007 or something like that, friendly game. So he wasn't too fussed about the turf, but a lot of other players are.
I think it's safe to say that these Stars in most sports don't like playing on turf. It's harder on your joints. Do you believe that there's a case to be made for discrimination with the sort of the venues that have turf for the Women's World Cup that wouldn't, obviously, for the men's?
Yeah, I think you could make a case. The thing about BC Place is you really can't have grass in there because just the way that it's built and the retractable roof, there wouldn't be enough sunlight and it would just be incredibly expensive to keep grass in there. So, I mean, I'd love to see a soccer played on grass. I think it's more fun to play on and it's more fun to watch.
Right.
They're just sort of certain intangibles. I mean, little things like being able to do a knee slide to the corner flag. You know, you can't do that on turf.
Right.
When you celebrate a goal or, you know, stuff like that.
I suppose you could.
You'd be out of the game.
That'd be the last thing you did that game.
Yeah.
I mean, Cormac, in the sort of global sense of the game, I mean, it is telling that Canada's defense essentially was that, look, we bid, no one else did. You knew the facilities we had. Mm-hmm. If you had a problem, don't give us the World Cup. I mean,
yeah,
we'll,
yeah, it's a really interesting one. I must admit, I'm not too kind of conversed on it, but I think it's the turf grass thing is really interesting, especially when you look at England. Obviously, there's no professional team in England that uses turf. I think there's one in the conference that did, and they got a lot of flack for it and a lot of kind of criticism. I can't remember the team off the top of my head.
So even in the northern teams that have, you
know. Totally, it's all grass. But then there's a lot of teams hate playing on this. I mean, when a lot of big name Premier League teams go away to a smaller, take Manchester United going away to Cambridge recently, the pitch plays a huge impact on the game, and a lot of teams struggle to really play if the grass isn't perfect. I think, also you'll know this too, it's really, when grass is perfect, it's a lot better to play on the turf, but when it's really muddy and you've got massive puddles, then you're kind of wishing you were on turf. So I think it's a really interesting line, and it's a tough decision to make.
Yeah. Well, in Canada, I mean, there are just certain realities you have to deal with. I mean, one of the venues is Edmonton.
Yeah.
I have memories watching CFL games on that when it was grass. And I can tell you right now, I'm sure, you know, people of our parents' age have memories of watching those CFL games too. And I can't imagine, you know, if it rains, it's hazardous. I mean, that being said, if you're saying the north of England plays in, you know, with grass, and does Portland play on grass?
I think they do.
Do you know if Seattle?
Seattle don't. I remember a couple of years ago, they had a friendly game or an international game that the U.S. were playing at CenturyLink Stadium. And they put grass on top of their turf.
Are you serious?
And then, the Whitecaps played, I guess, the weekend after, and the grass was still there, and Andy O'Brien pulled a hamstring, and he kind of blamed it on that turf.
Oh,
but,
God's
it's
sake.
Just, there's no real way to fix it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's just the sort of, the realities are, you're never going to have, I mean, the Blue Jays talk about this all the time with Rogers Centre. I mean, if Minnesota plays their games on grass, outdoors, Toronto probably could figure out a way of doing it. Milwaukee does the same thing. They have grass that's indoors, and they have these things called grow lights, and it's a big, expensive nightmare. But in the Women's World Cup sense, I mean, I guess let's just get off the turf grass. What are we going to do? It's Canada. What are we going to do? Is there palpable excitement in your guys' learned opinions in Canadian soccer for the Women's World Cup? Is this breaking through? Because TSN's putting a lot of money and promotion into it.
I'm really disappointed that it's only coming as far as Edmonton. I think when you look at the fact that there's a lot of MLS teams in the West. There's a lot of, I mean, you know, you've got the Whitecaps who, they were the only Canadian team to make the playoffs last season.
Yep.
Impact didn't make it.
Yeah. No, they were dreadful last year.
I mean, I think it's just a little ridiculous that there's obviously a really big market out here
for
it. I think it's a really big shame that the Women's World Cup isn't coming out this far. it makes sense, I guess, geographically, but it's still a shame.
Yeah, I mean, it does. That's a big deal. It's supposed to be, you know, representative of Canada. And TSN, if you watched it at all recently, they're selling it very much as this is Canada, you know, welcoming the world. Do you think this has the potential? I mean, outside of, I guess, the Pacific Northwest context, because, yeah, the games aren't physically coming here. Are people going to watch them? Do people care?
I think people... I remember years ago, there was an Under-19 World Cup, and, you know, Carl Lang, Christine Sinclair were just starting to get big, and that was huge. And now, after the big Olympic...
Oh, yeah.
You know, when they...
The Americans,
exactly.
The counting of the goalie. Like, I don't think I'd watched a women's... I mean, once again, I'll admit, for everyone to hear, I'm not a huge soccer fan, but I watched every moment of that Olympic game, and I was furious. You know what I mean? Like, it was really compelling theater, and that's, I think, what draws people. I mean, obviously, playing at a national stage, that draws people, absolutely. But I think there are a lot of bets being made that they're going to have to capitalize on that sort of momentum from the Olympics for the Women's World Cup.
Yeah.
I guess my question to you guys is, does Canada need a result here
to
sort of vault to the past?
Well, I think anybody who doesn't know a lot about soccer will think, oh, yeah, Canada, they're going to win it. You know, that's just kind of the...
You think so?
If they don't know a lot, but I really think they'll have a hard time. They're not quite at the same level as the U.S. and China and Brazil, who were the real powerhouses.
Because my thought would be, if you didn't know much about soccer, you would assume Canada's going to get killed.
Well, it's that for the men's game, they do, and they probably will.
And that's a topic for another discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
Altogether, the men's
but
national
the
team.
Women's team, if you think about it, the only thing that people have seen from the women's team has been good things lately, and that's sort of a source of pride with Canada soccer. Is that Canadian women's team? They're up there. Yeah, I think third place again might be good, but I, even with the home advantage, I'm not sure. They've got a really good coach. They got some really good players, but overall, I don't know if they have the quality to go and win the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, I think winning it would be really, really tough with, like you said, Brazil, the United States, China, and even England to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the home advantage will really help. I think they'll really, and like you said, you know, the whole country really is pulling for this. They're making a big deal out of it, and I don't think that's going to hurt them.
It might hurt them, and that's didn't we have a World Cup recently where they I can't remember if it was men's or women's. We didn't score a goal. Was that men's? I think under net. Was that the men's junior under 20?
The under 20. They just had their sort of Olympic qualifying tournament, and they scored a couple goals, but they basically won their first game and then just crash and burn for the rest of the tournament. And it was really disappointing, actually, because they were supposed to be sort of a new generation of Canadian soccer players. They had all the academy players from the MLS teams.
And that was in Canada?
That was, no, that was in Jamaica. Okay. It was like the Central American.
I wonder if the Canadian women's team has ever played where they are expected to win. And they're, like, as you were saying before, they're no longer sort of like good for them on the world stage like they were in the Olympics and taking on the U.S. and I think they beat France in the bronze medal game. But now it's we expect them to win. They got a good draw, I believe, in the pools. That was a favorable group
they
for them.
Pretty well, yeah.
They're expected to advance at least. Pressure's on. Like, this is a different ball game for them. This is theirs to lose now in that group. So that can...
I think whereas before you may have had, this women's soccer, it's just getting started. We don't really care about the results. We just want the culture to grow and grow. You know, we want more women to get into this. I think that's kind of over now. And I think women's soccer in Canada has reached a point where it's now becoming a bit more of a results game. I think because the standard is that much higher than it would have been in the past. And because of the recent successes that it's now. Obviously, we still want you to play well. And the style of soccer is always important. But yeah, I think definitely get out to a group. And top three would be maybe what he's pushing for if he did make it. I think we'd be really, really impressed and happy with them.
So, advance, past that's gravy probably, right? That's...
Yeah, and I'd say, out of the group, maybe win the first sort of playoff game. After that, it's iffy whether they keep going or not. Just, I guess it depends who they draw in those games as well and how the other big teams do. But
is there, I mean, let's... I don't know how much time we have for this, but Christine Sinclair... Mm-hmm. I would say is with Hayley Wickenheiser, probably the two most recognizable female athletes in Canada.
Yeah.
Sinclair might be the most dominant female soccer player on the planet now.
I'd say so, yeah. Right now, she's probably the biggest female soccer player. I mean, there's in the U.S., there are a couple of big players, Abby Wambach.
And, I remember her from the...
Yeah. definitely, I'd say Christine Sinclair is probably the biggest women's soccer player in the world, but she's also not getting any younger.
So right? I was going to say, this is the question. This is it for her, right?
This could be her sort of peak. I wouldn't say she's going to retire anytime soon. You know, I think she's got a few years left in her, but I don't... She's definitely... This is the high point she's going to get before the rest of her career. You know, she's not going to get any higher than this tournament.
All right, Alistair, prediction. How does Canada do in the Women's World Cup? Gun to your head, you got to make a call.
Lost in the semifinals.
Lost in the semis, huh? And then... Play for bronze, then?
Playing for bronze.
All right. Cormac, yeah. Prediction.
Yeah, I'd go with either the same loss in the semifinals, or if they get an unfavorable draw, loss in the quarterfinals.
Lost the course. Yeah. All right, well, that's about all the time we have. Cormac, plug this Whitecaps-Vikes game.
Yep, the UVic Vikes playing the Whitecaps. Couldn't remember the name for a second there. Playing the Whitecaps at Centennial Stadium, February 14th. I don't know the time off the top of my head. I think it's around 3 p.m.
Okay, that's a Sunday, I think?
Or? That's a Saturday.
Yeah,
Saturday,
okay. And there's actually a meet and greet with the Whitecaps players at from 12 until 12:30
Fantastic.
Before the game. So
you should come, because who knows when we're going to see high-level soccer in Victoria ever again.
Exactly. It's the last chance. We're going to fill up the stadium.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. This has been the second edition of the Martlett Sports Roundtable. Check back next week.